Last class, we computed the cross-section for producing Higgs bosons at the LHC in proton-proton collisions through gluon-gluon fusion at the parton level. So we computed the cross-sections. They were expressed in numbers of units of picobarn. And now I'm just going to ask kind of an experimentally motivated question, which is just how many Higgs bosons do you produce in the collider for a given cross-section, just to conclude the discussion of Higgs production. So we've computed the cross-section, and the question is just, what do we do with it? So I want to introduce concepts of luminosity. Luminosity, to consider luminosity, we're going to consider a simplified type of collider experiment where we have beams of particle A and particle B colliding with one another, like so. And I'm just going to assume that the number density of particles A and B are both individually just constant, okay, in our experiment. So this will have some number density NA, and this will have some number density NB. And of course, this is a simplification. At the LHC, particles A and B are protons, and they come in bunches. So it's not some uniform beam, but they come in lumps. So what I want to compute is essentially the rate. And so let me first compute something related, which is the rate divided by the volume. Okay, so I'm imagining that these two beams of particles are just streaming past one another. So the rate per unit volume is just the number density of A times the number density of B times the relative velocity times the cross-section. All right, you can just check that it has the right units. Should have units of 1 over time times volume. All right, so the rate, I just multiply by volume, is NA times NB times the relative velocity times the volume. And you want to think of the volume as sort of the overlap volume, all right? So in a real experiment, of course, there's not going to be some infinite beam, but I just want to consider the volume over which the two beams are overlapping. And then I multiply this factor by the cross-section to get the rate. Okay. So the rate basically factorizes, at least in this very simplified context, into the product of two terms. One is the particle physics part that we can compute from the underlying model, which is the cross-section. And then times a bunch of factors, which depend on the details of the experimental setup. All right. And so in this very, very simplified type of setup, it's just given by this. But for a more complicated setup, it works the same way. It's just a little more complicated of an expression. So this whole thing is known as the luminosity, which I denote by L. So the luminosity depends on the experimental setup. And it has units of area divided by time. That's not right. 1 over area times time. Since when I multiply by the cross-sectional area, I get a rate. Okay, there's also a related concept called the integrated luminosity. Which is denoted by an integral dt times luminosity. This has units of area. And it's basically just the number of collisions after a given running time of the experiment per unit cross-section. So anytime the collider experiments will quote some results, they always quote what their luminosity is at a given energy. So the Higgs discovery is based on an integrated luminosity of around 5 femtobarn, inverse femtobarn, at 7 TeV. This is a square root of S. And about the same, 5 inverse femtobarn at 8 TeV. Okay, so it's very easy now to compute how many events we expect for the Higgs boson, how many Higgs bosons are produced. You just take the integrated luminosity, which is units of 1 over cross-section, multiply by the cross-section, and that's the number of events. So the number of events So we have, let me mention one other thing. 1 femtobarn is equal to 10 to the minus 3 picobarn. So we have 5 inverse femtobarn times 15.1 picobarn, or so I could write this as 5.1 times 10 to the 3 femtobarn. Is equal to 75,000 Higgs events. And the same thing at 8 TeV. So we have around 5 inverse femtobarn times 19.3 times 10 to the 3 femtobarn is around 100,000 Higgs events. So they had lots of events, right, when they claimed the discovery in principle. But the problem is not all of them decay into a way which is experimentally distinct or gives a distinct signal, a well-measured signal. Now remember, the dominant decays were BB bar, WW, and glue. So those are the three leading decays of the Higgs. BB bar, you produce lots of BB bar pairs just through the strong interaction. WW, it's difficult to know that you found the Higgs boson because you can't reconstruct the total mass of the Higgs in the case where the W decays leptonically because you have the neutrinos. And so those are missing energy in the detector. When the W's decay hadronically, again, you run into this problem that it's very easy to produce hadronic states in at the LHC, and so it's tough to pick out the ones that are due to the Higgs. And glue has the same problem. Gluons are produced copiously at the LHC. So all of these things are challenging experimentally. That's not to say that we can't detect the Higgs boson in BB bar or WW. This one is probably very, very tough. And we have, okay? But it just wasn't the cleanest way to detect it. So the cleanest one were ZZ star and gamma gamma. And in fact, gamma gamma was the most clean. But you're limited by the fact that not all of these Higgs events decayed into gamma gamma because the branching ratio is really small. So the branching ratio for Higgs to gamma gamma is around 0.15%. So when you take into account this very small branching ratio, this translates into around 250 Higgs to gamma gamma events when it was discovered. Okay. But of course, you don't necessarily see all of these Higgs to gamma gamma events because you're limited further by limitations of the experimental detector, right? Sometimes you miss one of the photons, then you miss the Higgs, okay? So you're limited by the efficiency of your detection. Okay. So any questions on this? Because we're gonna change gears and talk about a new topic. Yeah?
Over how much time are you integrating here? Like the runtime of the LHC, like a couple of years, or?
Yeah, so there's two different types of runtime. One is actual time, but the experiment is not running fully during all of the real time. Okay, so what's the runtime of the actual experiment? It's a bit less, let's say. But this came from, I think, of order a year each of sort of physical real time. And then how much is the experiment running? I think something around 30 to 50%, if I remember correctly. But maybe someone else knows better than me. Something like that. Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
How do they do to measure the spin of the particle? I mean, how are they showing the
young? Yeah, that's an important question to figure out. So so basically, it depends what the decay is. For Higgs to gamma gamma, what you're looking at is sort of the distribution of the photons. If it decays, if you have a spin zero photon, then ultimately the operator is Higgs coupled to F mu nu, F mu nu. Okay? So if it decays in this way, there's a particular relationship between all of the momenta and the polarizations. And so that's something you can measure. If it's, for example, a parity odd spin zero particle, then it would couple like this, H to F dual. Okay, so then you get a different relationship between the momenta and the polarization vectors.
Do they measure polarizations in Atlas and?
Well, let's see. So now I'm a bit unsure.
Atlas is the only one that can.
Yeah, let's see. So. Actually, to be honest, I'm not 100% sure.
The big ones don't.
So let's see. So if you I don't remember exactly the details.
But then they just measure the four momentum of the two photons, add it together, and then see what, like hypothetically, if they came from the decay of some particle, what mass that particle would have had?
Yeah, that's the first step. Yeah, maybe the better option is, so for distinguishing the parity, I don't remember the details. For spin one for spin zero, you'd expect the photons to decay isotropically, but for other choices of spin, you can imagine something else. So spin one is not allowed by Yang's theorem, but you could also have spin two. So for example, the Higgs might have been some graviton-like state, okay? So we could have had a spin two state decaying into two photons. There you would have a different angular dependence on the angle between the photons. Okay. Yeah, but for parity, yeah, I'm not exactly sure. It's yeah, so it might be something more complicated. You can look for so you can look for not just photons, but you can look for photons that get converted into electron-positron pairs. These are called converted photons. And so these might have some information about the polarization of the photon, depending on how the electron-positron pairs are aligned.
I think in ATLAS and what's the other one called?
CMS.
Yeah, I think neither of them can measure polarizations or spins of anything. There's just nothing in the detector that can measure that.
Yeah, so what I'm guessing is that polarization of the photon, even though they can't measure that directly, if it gets converted into an electron-positron pair, then that can carry, just through the kinematics of the electron-positron pair, some information about the polarization of the photon that it comes from. So you can search for things like that.
But an electron, like whether it's like left-handed or right-handed, is only going to interact differently with stuff through weak force, which is appropriately called the weak force.
No, yeah, I don't mean it interacts differently. I just mean it has a different momentum dependence when it decays. Let's see. So maybe it's not through the photon decay that you can distinguish these things. It could be, yeah, I'm kind of guessing here. So it could be through the Z channel that you can distinguish the parity cases. So I don't know, to be honest. So you can also do the measurement through Higgs to ZZ. And if it's a parity even spin one state, then you'll have this type of operator with a coupling of G mz squared over V. But if it's a parity odd state, then you can decay through this type of operator, where this is supposed to be the field strength tensor corresponding to the Z. And so it could be that different polarizations of the Z can give different kinematic dependencies of the fermions when they decay. So that could be one option. But yeah, OK, I'm not too sure on the details. Any other questions on this? Otherwise, we're going to change gears. So I want to pass something out. So I was going to write out this table on the board. But I can spare myself some work and just pass it out. And unfortunately, print it out on this giant sheet of paper in color, which is not exactly my intention. There we go. Everyone get one? Okay. So the topic that we're going to discuss is hadron spectroscopy. And group theory. So we discussed a bit about QCD at very high energies in terms of how we compute observables in colliders, in the cross sections. And we took advantage of the fact that QCD has asymptotic freedom. All right, so we could treat alpha S perturbatively, and you can perform perturbative calculations even if your initial and final states are hadronic states. The only thing you need to watch out for are these PDFs characterizing the initial state. Now we're going to go to the opposite extreme. We're going to consider quarks at low energies. And of course, they are confined in hadrons, color-neutral mesons, or baryons. And so we're going to discuss these states. So experimentally, or I should say historically, the study of these states, and you know, started out as quite a mess because there are more and more of these states being discovered, and people wanted to know how you could make sense out of them. You know, no one wants to write down a Lagrangian that has, you know, 100 different fields in it with lots of parameters characterizing the interaction of these fields. So we want to know how to make sense out of these states. So nature has actually been fairly kind to us in terms of giving us sort of a rich phenomenology to study. So hadrons are characterized not just by the confinement scale of QCD, around 200 MeV, but also based on the masses of the quarks, which form the hadrons. Now, there's a range of different quark masses that occur in nature, which is great because we can study hadrons which have very different properties. There are light quarks, such as the U and D quarks, and also strange is light-ish, but not very light. There are also heavy quarks, such as charm and bottom quarks. And so you can have hadrons formed of either light quarks, which are just called light quark hadrons, and you can have hadrons made out of heavy quarks, known as heavy quark hadrons, containing a C or a B quark. The top quark does not form hadrons. It decays before it hadronizes, and so effectively the top quark is a free quark. All right, so if you open the PDG, and you can choose either mesons or baryons. PDG stands for Particle Data Group, so you can look at the Particle Data Book, open your favorite section, and look for your favorite mesons or baryons, and you can see that there are lots of these different states. And so I just made a table of what the lightest states are, what we think their quark content is, and what their lifetime is, their spin and parity, and what their leading decays are. Okay, so we can just go down the list here. So you start out with pions, which are the lightest states, and the neutral pion decays electromagnetically, and the charged pion decays through the weak interaction. So the next heaviest state are the kaons, which we know now involve strange quarks. But at the time, they were just slightly heavier versions of the pion. There were charged kaons and there were neutral kaons. And the lifetimes of the kaons were also relatively long, of order 10 to the minus 8 for the charged kaons and 10 to the minus 8 or 10 to the minus 10 for the neutral kaons. And the kaons decay to pions or potentially to leptons, which we know has to happen through the weak interaction. The next heaviest state is called the F0. It's a bit of an outlier that we're not going to discuss, and people think it could be some type of pion-pion bound state. But as we go to the next highest state is the eta. It has a given quark content and a mass around 550 MeV, and it decays fairly rapidly. So then as you go up to higher mass, you encounter spin-1 hadrons, namely the rho, the neutral and charged rho, the omega meson, and also spin-1 analogs of the kaon, which carry the same quark content as the pseudoscalar kaons. And then as you go to even higher mass, you have the eta prime, around 950 MeV, and then you have the phi, which is a vector meson, around 1 GeV. Okay, so the takeaway point from this is the lightest states seem to be pseudoscalar mesons and also spin one vector mesons with negative parity for the most part. Okay, so now if we turn to the baryons, we have the proton and neutron. The next heavier state is called the lambda, which the quark content is just UDS. And then the next heavier state is called the sigma baryon, which can be a sigma plus, a sigma zero, sigma minus. Then you have heavier states called the delta, which can carry different charges depending on the quark content. And then you have doubly strange baryons, which are denoted by the capital letter C, which are also called cascades. Then you have even heavier states still, analogs of the sigma, called the sigma star. And these have the same quark content as a sigma, they're just spin 3/2 instead of spin 1/2. And then you have the cascade star, which are also spin 3/2. And then you have a state called the delta minus, which is comprised of three strange quarks. Plus many, many other states, which are also there, but I'm just focusing on the lighter ones. Okay. All right, so those, that's kind of a lightning tour of the beginning of the particle data book. And so what I want to ask is, okay, if you open this up, it looks like a mess. Are there any hints toward an organizing principle? Okay, so the first thing is that some hadrons, and for example, these would be kaons, the lambda, the sigmas, the cascades, and then the delta minus are produced very easily. In collisions, but have a long decay time. Compared to other states. So just to give you an example of this, if you look, for example, at the rho decays to pi pi, and the lifetime is very fast. We know now that it's decaying through the strong interaction. That's why the lifetime is so short. But you can compare that to the kaons, which also decay a fraction of the time to pi pi, but their lifetime is slower by almost 20 orders of magnitude. All right. So it's a kind of a puzzle, considering that to produce them, the production rate seems to be very similar to one another. All right. So we know now that the reason for this vast discrepancy is the fact that we have strange quarks. So there's a new quantum number that people invented to account for this called strangeness. Of course, when people are studying this, strange quarks in the weak interaction were unknown at the time. And so what they did is postulate a new additive quantum number strangeness, and the argument is that it's conserved by the strong interaction but must be violated in the decay of particles that carry strangeness, okay? So we know it's violated in the weak interaction now, but that was the argument at the time. So it's conserved by a strong interaction, which is responsible for production, but violated in the decay. Just through the weak interaction. And the convention is that the strangeness of the K plus is equal to 1. The strangeness of the lambda is equal to minus 1, etc., meaning that the S quark has S equals minus 1. Okay. I don't mean to say that you need to use the convention to assign strangeness to every single type. Once you assign it to one and you see how they interact, you can figure out the strangeness for all of the others. But ultimately, we know now that we did it backwards. So the strange antiquark has strangeness plus one, unfortunately, but it's historical. So the second thing that you notice is that hadrons come in nearly degenerate multiplets. So for example, you have the proton and neutron have are very nearly degenerate in mass. You have the pions are also nearly degenerate. Some states are not degenerate with any other state. So you might have just one state here, like the lambda, for example. Or the delta has four states, et cetera. So this is, it points to a new symmetry, which you may know is called isospin. And so different multiplets would be different representations under isospin. So this would be a doublet, which would be I equals 1/2. This is a triplet, so it would be I equals 1. This is a singlet, I equals 0. And this would be a quadruplet. I equals 3/2. And the analogy is with spin, of course, right? So the argument is that, well, if the strong interaction is the dominantly responsible for the mass of all of these hadronic states, then if the strong interaction preserves isospin, then the states themselves should also preserve isospin. But you can have other forces, of course, like the weak in the electromagnetic interaction, that that violate isospin. And so there's no reason that each of these multiplets, the components of the multiplets, should have the same electric charge and interactions to the weak Hamiltonian. Right. So different components. Have different electric charge. And possibly different decays. So this tells us that electromagnetic and weak interactions can violate isospin. But the strong interaction preserves it. Okay, so probably you've seen isospin before, but in case you haven't, what I mean is that these different multiplets, which contain different particles, obey, or I should say, are representations of an SU2 symmetry. which works exactly the same way to what you do for spin in quantum mechanics. So for example, if you have a proton state, you can act on it with the three component of isospin, and you'll just get plus 1/2 times the proton state. Or if you have the I squared operator acting on the proton state, this would just be I times I plus 1 of the proton state. And so I here is just 1/2, and so this would be 3/4 times the proton state. Okay. And similarly for the neutron, I3 on the neutron is equal to minus 1/2 on the neutron. All right. And I squared is the same as the proton. Okay, so it just works like spin. Okay, so we have one type of grouping. We can group together states which are nearly degenerate in these isospin multiplets. But we can also group together states in kind of a broader way, which is called the eightfold way. So this was invented by Gell-Mann and Neyman. So they showed how to embed these two approximate symmetries. By that I mean isospin and strangeness. Within a larger symmetry group. Which was SU3. Okay, so what we're gonna do is consider states of a given angular momentum, a given spin, J, and a given parity P in the I3S plane. So first we'll consider the pseudoscalar mesons. So these would be JP equals 0 minus. So this axis will be I3, and this axis will be S. So now I'm just, for every particle, I'm going to put a dot in this plane. So let's put 1 here, and this will be 1/2, and then 1 here. This will be minus 1/2 and minus 1, and this will be minus 1. Okay, so so I have the K plus here, K0 here, I have the pions, pi minus, pi 0 and pi plus. And then I have the k minus and the k bar 0. And then I also have one more state, which is the eta, which is also here in the center. So maybe I can draw it like this. OK, so these are all of the 8 lightest pseudoscalar states. So this is also known as the pseudoscalar octet. Then if you go to heavier masses, there's another pseudoscalar state called the eta prime, which is a singlet. This one's quite a bit heavier than the others. So now we're going to do the same exercise for the baryons. So we'll do spin 1/2 baryons, and I'll make the same plot. So this is minus 1, plus 1. This is strangeness 1, and strange minus 1, strangeness minus 2. Okay, so the neutron and proton are here. Then we have the sigma minus. And then at this point here, which I'm drawing offset a little bit, we have the lambda and the sigma 0. And then here we have the sigma plus. And then down here we have the cascade minus. And here is the cascade 0. This is known as the baryon octet. Now what we're going to do is the spin 3/2 baryons. Okay, so we have 1/2, 1/3, minus 1/2, 1, minus 3/2. So this is minus 1, this is plus 1. Then we have strangeness minus 1, strangeness minus 2, strangeness minus 3. Okay, so this state here is the delta minus. This is the delta 0, this is the delta plus, and this is the delta plus plus. Okay, then we have, stay here, is the sigma minus star. This is the sigma star 0, and this is the sigma star plus. And this is the cascade star minus, and then this is the cascade star 0, and then down here is the omega minus. Okay, is that legible? Not sure. Okay, this is the baryon decuplet. Okay. So these things are essentially pretty pictures so far. But they seem to follow this organizing principle in that they form, when we take all of the states, all of the lightest states of a given spin and of a given parity, they're all grouped together in these diagrams. So what I want to argue next is, say, where do these symmetries come from, and why do they organize in these patterns? So I'm going to argue that these come from representations of SU3 symmetry. But where does the SU3 symmetry come from? Yeah.
Particles, they are like experimental measure, or is there like any reason to believe that?
Which ones? I3 and S?
I mean the parity for
Yeah, the parity comes experimentally. Yeah, so it's kind of experimental. You kind of build it up, so you can start out with the pions and ask, okay, what's the parity of the pions given their kinematics, and kind of build it up from there. For example, you have kaons decaying into two pions. You can ask sort of what's the orbital angular momentum based on the outgoing kinematics of the pions, and also include what's the intrinsic parity of the pions as well. So it allows you to sort of build up the whole chain of what the parity of all of these states is. Okay. So we're going to consider symmetry of the strong interaction. So we're going to start from the standard model Lagrangian. And we're going to neglect electroweak interactions. And so if we just focus on the quark Lagrangian, we have a sum over quark flavors, Q bar I covariant derivative, which is D slash minus I GS, generator of SU3. And then we have the gluon fields, G slash A, and then the mass of the quark, MQ, Q. And then we have the gluon field strength term, which is 1/2 trace of G mu nu, G mu nu. Okay, so this is only considering quarks and gluons. Let's see if this is really going to be important. Okay. All right. So G is the gluon fields, and MQ is a quark mass, and TA is the generator of SU3 color. All right, and so the quarks as well is a sum over all the different types. Okay, so what I want to do to start with is just consider the light quarks. Which will U, D, and S. I'm also going to take to be a light quark as well. If the light quarks have masses which are much, much smaller than the typical scale of QCD, then I can take them to be effectively massless, which means that I can treat them as being degenerate. So since hadron masses from QCD, we can treat quarks as being degenerate. Since I can approximate them as being massless, if MQ is much, much less than lambda QCD. All right. And for the strange quark, the mass of the strange quark is around 100 MeV, which is not really much less than lambda QCD. So we'll get to that caveat in a minute. But for the moment, let's just take the strange quark to be light. So let's set MU, MD, and MS to be just a universal mass, which I'll call M naught. So I can write the strong Lagrangian in the following way. I d slash minus I gs g slash a ta minus m naught q minus 1/2 trace of g mu nu. We're now, instead of summing over the different quarks, I want to write this as sort of a matrix equation, where now Q is just a vector, a three-component vector containing the U, D, and S fields. Everything here in parentheses doesn't care about whether it's U, D, or S, since M naught is just a constant mass. So the whole thing in this flavor space is just proportional to the identity. So this is a triplet of flavor. So now the Lagrangian as an SU3 flavor symmetry, where I just start with my triplet UDS, and I rotate by an SU3 matrix, like so. Okay, and so it's probably obvious that the Lagrangian that I wrote is invariant under this transformation, since everything in parentheses is just proportional to the identity in flavor space. Now let's consider the electromagnetic interactions. So the electromagnetic interaction looks like as follows. E Q bar times a capital Q, which I'll define in a second, gamma mu Q A mu. So now, again, I'm writing Q as my triplet of flavor. And this capital Q is now going to be a matrix, which is just the electric charges of the three quarks And so it was just 2/3 minus 1/3 minus 1/3. And then 0 on the other components. So it's clear that this term does not preserve the SU3 symmetry. If you insert U dagger here in U, Q will get transformed to, the term will not be invariant because the U dagger doesn't commute through the U as it would if all of the quarks carried the same electric charge. So the punchline is just that the electromagnetic interaction violates SU3. Violates this SU3 flavor symmetry. All right? And that's exactly what we wanted, because different multiplets of the symmetry carry different electric charge. So another effect that's going to be important is the fact that the strange quark mass is not small compared to the scale of lambda QCD, and it's not small compared to the masses of the other quarks. So that's going to be important as well. All right, so MS is not small compared to lambda QCD, and also MS is much larger than MU and MD. Okay, so this approximation that all the quarks have a universal mass is not going to end up being a great approximation. But instead of writing what we should have done, so we started out with our mass matrix like this. And what we did is we wrote it as a common mass times the identity. So instead of writing this, we should have written it like this. Mu, Md, Ms should be a common mass for the U and D quarks. And then the strange quark still has its own mass, Ms. So this would have been a better approximation if we wrote this. But the point I want to try to make now is just that even though the SU3 symmetry is going to be broken by the fact that the strange quark mass is not too small, there still remains a subgroup of SU3, which should be a good symmetry, better than the full SU3 symmetry. And so this is just isospin. So the SU2 subgroup acting on U and D is a much better symmetry. Then the full SU3 flavor symmetry, which acts on UDS. Okay, so this is isospin. All right. So I'm out of time. So let's pause here, and then we're going to continue the discussion on Wednesday.